It's your daily sports dump. And I'm your host, Joe Canelli. That's right, folks. It's me, your host, Joe Canelli. It's your daily sports dump. It's Tuesday, May 26th. I'm not going to waste any of your time. I'm going to get right to it. We have a great guest today, very funny man. Like myself, he was an improv nerd, so the first 4 minutes of this conversation is improv nerdy. But then we get into a sport that's almost as nerdy as improv, cycling. And he gets into the dirt about why he did not watch the Lance Armstrong 30 for 30. And he makes a pretty good point for it. And we go all over the place, but it all circles around cycling, which is a much dirtier and more interesting sport than you might have imagined. Please sit back and enjoy Tim Baltz, star of Stage and Screen, talking sports on the Daily Sports Dump. And apologies to my friend Peter, who also should be our Sports Dump cycling correspondent. Here we are. All right, and we are here with the Sports Dump cycling expert. I don't know if you knew this was your title, Tim. Tim Baltz. Also, first of all, welcome to the show, Tim.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Are you okay with being our cycling expert?
Yeah, sure.
Excellent. Excellent. It doesn't come up much, but and if folks, you should know Tim from many, many episodes of Drunk History, where he's played many historical figures. Give me your favorite figure you've played, Tim.
Well, everyone's favorite figure is Hitler. We all get a chance to do it multiple times. Oh, you mean on Drunk History?
You're right. How could that be anyone's not favorite? Yes.
Derek Waters made it, and Jeremy Connors made it a point to let everyone play Hitler. I think I played him twice.
Dude, I've seen... I can't say I've seen every episode, and I definitely haven't seen you play Hitler, but now I'll go look for you to play Hitler. And, of course, BJ in The Righteous Gemstones. I asked you it twice, and then I botched the name when I said it.
Literally two words native to your English language.
Yes. I try to botch something early, and then throughout for consistency. So, and you are a cycling fan.
And I am, yeah.
And just so everyone knows, or at least so you know, what I remember you best from, I've known you and known of you for a long time, but whatever that bit you did at Second City with those glasses.
Oh, positive guy?
Just think,
you would like that.
Oh, of course, dude. I'm a big fan of doing a bit where the prop is doing a lot of the work for you, and then you just ride it. And to be fair, it doesn't do everything. So,
right. Well, you would love how the origin story of that bit, because I think this is very much like the way that you probably created a lot of things. But this was almost a bluff pitch from me. We were probably like 4 or 5 weeks into process, and our director, Matt Hubby, was like,
okay, that's what I was going to ask, who the director was. Okay, so this is making sense. Go on.
And he said, so you know whereabout we're at, like where the running order is at, like what shape it's in. And he said, he gave us a really open-ended assignment. He was just like, just make it 2 minutes. I don't care what it is. It can be whatever, but it can't be more than 2 minutes long.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I had gotten a bunch of things in the show already. And so I was a little burned out.
Uh-huh.
And I think my dad or my sister had gotten us, like as a family, those glasses for Christmas. So this was probably in like late February. So. Mm-hmm. They were sitting in my room, and I'm like, I got to run to the Brown Line. I live near the diversity stop. And I was like, shit, I'm running out of time. I grabbed the glasses. I was brushing my teeth. I put them on, and I just started going. I was like, all right, don't be negative about this, man. You're like, just whatever is going to be fine. You really didn't do your homework.
Right,
and I started
right.
going, I'm a positive guy. And I started laughing, and then I looked at the clock, and I was like, oh, shit, I got to go. And I wrote the entire thing on the train, and then I showed up, and Hubby was like, what do you got? I'm like, let me just print it out. And then I transcribed everything I had as fast as I could. I printed it out. I passed it out. I was like, okay, you're a pizza box. You're my ex-wife.
That's improv inspiration there. I mean, most improvisers, I find, have a level of ADD.
Yeah.
And so just, you know, so many sketches are scribbled out on a train or whatever. Like, I was going to say, I appreciate that sketch because I did a polar bear bit, which you maybe saw.
Yeah.
And that was from some corporate gig. It was in Kelly's office, the producer at Second City. And again, I was short one pitch, and I walked by. I was like, what the hell's that? And it was, they were returning it to the thing. I'm like, well, when do you have to return it? And it was like the next day. And I said, okay, I'm going to try to do this in the show tonight. And and all I did is I said, here's my pitch. And I just came out with the thing. And he's like, that's your pitch? I was like, well, I'm a polar bear and I'm angry because I'm going to be extinct. And that's about all it really was. you know, that's... And that's it. And he's like, all right, all right. And so when I, you know, it struck me that Hovde would probably, he'd go for at least letting you try that. And then again, once it pulls laughs, it gets to stay.
Yeah, if it fits, you know.
Right.
And
yes.
It gets laughs. Yeah,
absolutely.
That went in the set that night, and it crushed. And then he was like, "It's in the show."
I'm oh
like,
yeah, man!
Really? There's no waiting period. And he's like, "No, it fits this need."
That made yeah laughter.
Oh, did I ever tell you? Well, I don't want to hijack this.
No. Well, do one more, and then we'll get sports. That's fine.
It's a cycling episode,
so improv is actually more relevant than cycling.
Yeah, people are going to tune in for this part, not whatever I have to say about Laurent Fignon. did I ever tell you the Darth Vader sketch story?
No, I'd like to hear it.
The reason I tell you is in part. Well, you'll appreciate why I thought this was going to work and how I came about the idea. So Steve Waltine had one of those Darth Vader helmets that had this thing that came off the helmet and dangled in front of you over your chest. And it looks like Darth Vader's costume, but it has these batteries in it and it modulates your voice.
Right.
When your head. Yeah. You've seen this.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yes.
All right. So Steve brought it by. And he was talking about how he like wears it at home. And I was like, oh, okay, not my style, but whatever. And then he put it on and it modulated his voice. And I started thinking like, oh man. And, so I probably left Ale House, you know, at like 1 or 2 in the morning. Yes. I walked 45 minutes home, which was so stupid.
Oh, God.
I did this all the time. I walk home and I'm thinking about it. I'm like, man, I'm going to write a sketch before I go to sleep. Like, I'm inspired. So I write this huge mapping scene about I'm Darth Vader.
Yeah.
Steve's like, yeah, you can wear this. He does a great Emperor Palpatine. So I was like, you're Emperor Palpatine. And then we have all these Jedis and I'm going to execute them. So I walk in and I pitch it to Matt and we do it in rehearsal. And Matt's like, okay, it's going in the set. I'm like, yes. Okay. We got this. So you got these three Jedis lined up and they're all like handcuffed, you know, and then Darth Vader and Emperor Palpatine come into the Vader death march, you know, bah, bah, bah. Yes. I got a cape on and black gloves. And I'm like, I'm swinging the cape around and the crowd's going wild. And I'm like, this is great. But bear in mind, like I can't hear anything because my head is in this.
Right.
Mask.
There's no hearing at all.
And you can only see a tiny bit out of this mask.
And it's very dark, right? Isn't it like?
Oh, yeah. So I'm trying not to fall off the stage. And I get out there. And the whole thing was this mapping scene where Emperor Palpatine was like, yes, now, Vader, you're going to prove yourself and kill these Jedi right in front of me. And I'm like, absolutely, Emperor. And then when I start choking them, and Palpatine's like, yes, choke the unwed single mother. And I'm like, wait, what? And he's like, yeah, choke the Jedi. I was like, no, what'd you say before that? He's like, well, you know, she's an unwed single mother. Like, she doesn't deserve to like draw from the benefits of the Empire. I'm like, no, let's move on. I just want to choke Jedis. And then every Jedi represented like a different thing that white supremacists hate, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, a dreamer. Dreamer Jedi. Man. Get him out.
And the thing was, we still needed like that one scene in the show that people would be like, wow, like that blew my mind. So I'm looking through these little slits in the mask.
Right.
And all my castmates are breaking. All of them. And I look at the crowd and everyone in the crowd is breaking. And I'm like, God damn it. This is like week 9.
All right, right. So now everything, yeah, everything gets like one chance maybe.
Everything, one chance. And like, you're really looking, you're trying to like throw a dart through a keyhole.
Yes.
And I'm like, God damn it. I did it. I fucking did it. This scene is slaying. The crowd is like, people in the front row are doubled over. They're crying, laughing. Everyone on stage is laughing. Waltine's doing his Palpatine perfectly, and I'm like stomping around the stage in my Vader outfit. The lights go down. I get off stage. I walk into the green room. I take off the helmet. My hair's all messed up. And Hubby walks in. I go, well, Matt, I did it again. And he goes, Tim, you need to know, not a single person out there understood a word you said. For 6 minutes, you stomped around stage dressed as Darth Vader, and all we heard was wah, 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 wah.
Like Snoopy adults. Not Snoopy, yes. Charlie. Is that it? Is it Charlie Brown the teachers? Yes.
Yeah. Wah, 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 wah. The entire time. And no one stopped me for like 6 minutes.
That should have stayed in.
Oh my God.
It'd be the easiest role to understudy.
Yeah. Anyway, that's my favorite total failure sketch.
Did you do that on your last night?
No, I did this one called Toucan Scientist that you would have liked.
Oh, Toucan. Yes.
I'll tell you about that another time, but that was the one that I was like, oh, that should have been in the show, but I pitched it at the wrong time and it just didn't get in.
Yeah. I know what you mean. Toucan is going to be my kid does one of my kids does this little animal show, Val's Animal Pals, and Toucan is her next episode. So look at that.
Oh, hey. Yeah,
small
nice.
World.
Yeah.
All right. So from improv to toucans to something more obscure, cycling. and the reason we're talking about it is this Lance Armstrong, you know, ESPN is just leaning on strong personalities and documentaries about them in the absence of sports. And I think where Jordan, we all know Jordan's story, but getting Jordan to talk about it is the big thing. With Lance Armstrong, I feel like people are less interested in hearing what he has to say.
Yeah. Well, now, he's been talking the
yes,
whole time.
Yes.
Like Jordan, everyone has been talking about Jordan the entire time, but Lance has been the one controlling the narrative, which is why he got to win 7 Tour de France titles, which have been revoked, because he cheated the entire time. And he said, I have never cheated the entire time. He grabs the microphone anytime there's a microphone near him.
Yes, he's a bully.
He is.
He's Trumpian in some ways, actually. A better athlete.
Yep.
Better athlete.
Yeah.
I'm guessing you at least watched some of the documentary last night.
No, I didn't watch it. I've seen,
you know, a lot about
Lance.
It.
Yeah. I've seen the other Lance documentaries. I watched the tour a lot. You know, I always had suspicions that he was doping because that's just where the sport was at the time. Cause it had changed so much from when I was a kid watching it.
Yes. And your link to it as a child was through your grandfather.
Yeah, so my mom is from the north of France, and you know, we didn't really go on vacations as kids, but my grandparents would help us go over there and visit, and so we'd stay with them for a few weeks, and it happened to be the few weeks of the tour every year in the summer.
Oh my goodness! So like July, early July, late June, is that right?
Yeah.
Hold on a second.
Yeah.
Hold on.
No, I think you're right.
No feedback protection, monitor on. There ain't no feedback here. Sorry, my feedback alarm went on. That's never happened before.
Oh, no worries.
There's no
Was
feedback.
It me?
No, it's glitching out, man. Who knows? Anyway, so what region of France, by the way?
The north, right outside this town called Lille, which is...
Oh, sure, Lille.
Like,
Lille, yeah. Lille has a... They have a decent soccer team, don't they?
Yeah, they're, I mean, you know, everything... outside of France, like except for Lyon for a little while, Paris, PSG,
yeah,
Marseille would, you know, compete every once in a while. But for the most part, Lille is like in the top five of the French league.
It's so boring, though, in the French league where you have PSG. I don't get, you know, even Spain where you have two teams battling every year. At least in the Premier League, there's some turnover. But I'm surprised at how satisfied people are with such little turnover at the top of these leagues. Getting off topic completely, but...
No, it's true, because the bottom of the leagues are more interesting than the top.
Yes, well, like, that's what relegation is, what keeps it all interesting.
Yeah. But Lille is kind of like the Chicago of France in a certain way. Like, it's an industrial kind of, you know, gray skies.
Right.
Kind of city. Obviously, like, it's nowhere near as big. And
you paint a pretty bleak picture of Chicago, actually, Tim.
Yeah, that's true. The north of France is a little bleaker than Chicago. But I love it.
North of France sounds awesome. Of course, you know, just whatever of France sounds awesome, but who knows what it is. Honestly, I have no idea.
It's beautiful. It's usually the start of the tour goes through northern France at some point, and there's a huge race from Paris to my mom's hometown, which is called Roubaix.
Okay.
So Paris-Roubaix is like one of the Masters classics, but it's only one day. And
sure.
It's like a lot of cobblestone streets. Anyway, it's very like steeped in cycling history. And my grandpa was huge into the tour. He was, when the war broke out, he was like 16 or 17. And so you can like, you know, 1939.
Sure,
early 1940, and my grandma, who he wasn't married to yet, she was older than he was, her dad went to my grandpa and said, so my great-grandfather went to my grandfather and said, here's the deal, like, we're soon going to be overrun. I'm sending the women and the children to the south to basically hide out with family and friends. If you go with them, they'll stop you and they'll throw you in a POW camp. So here's a map. You're going to take your bicycle and you're going to go along this route to avoid all the major checkpoints. And then you're going to meet up with the women and children in this town, ask for these people, and you're going to basically like make sure that they're safe.
Oh, wow. You
know, who knows how long. So like cycling was a big part of the family history.
Yeah.
And the cool thing about
survival.
The Tour de France, yeah, to get less historic about it and just focus on the you know, the tour,
sure.
is that it starts in the kind of mid-afternoon and it ends like right around when the workday ends.
Yeah.
So if you're out at a cafe or, you know, or a bar, like people have just gotten off work and, you know, it's hot out and everyone's like having a beer or wine and they're watching the end of the tour, and the stages are so long that it's kind of like the most interesting part.
It's always at the end, and that's usually when they're coming into a more populous area is the finish of these.
Yeah.
And obviously they time it out that way to get a good, like, it's like you want that good early Saturday show crowd where they're a little drunk and having a good time. You don't want that second show Friday crowd.
No.
Where they're still drunk but they're angry.
Yeah, they're pissed about their jobs. They're mad at their dates.
Yeah.
they just want to be home.
They do. And France takes the cycling more seriously than anywhere. That's what I gathered. So I watched the first, like, hour. It's 2 hours, first hour 20, which was really mostly biographical. The one thing that stuck out to me was every person they spoke to, none of the cyclists. The cyclists didn't say this, but every non-cyclist they spoke to, like journalist or whatever, was skeptical about this and was like, Lance is going to try to grab the narrative of this and control this thing. Like, those were their first comments to all the people. And all the cyclists, the first question they asked was, when did you first dope? And all the cyclists are like, whoa, we're going to go there? It's like, yeah, what else are we going to talk about? When did you first love cycling? So it didn't really shine too much light, and there's a lot of Lance. So anytime he's talking the whole time, obviously he's controlling the narrative. And he's a compelling guy and everything, but I just don't see going forward. What the difference between him and Jordan is, okay, we're getting this testicular cancer story and the comeback and everything, but then the deeds he did were so despicable. Jordan didn't do anything like that.
No, and Lance is like, he always has to be telling you how great he is. Whereas Jordan, you know, at least had that other mode where he's like, see you out there.
Right.
Like, talk trash to me when it's 0-0.
Well,
you know,
and
talk trash when you're behind.
And there's no one who's ever backed it up in history like him. And yes, throughout The Last Dance, when they're, you know, when Jordan, when something's coming up, he's like, you know, I just say, you know, you win the MVP, so okay, well, let's do this.
Yeah.
And he wins another championship. Okay. You know, like, the slights were so tiny, but he drew them out. You know, George Karl is trying not to be manipulated by Jordan, and that turns into the thing that Jordan uses against him.
Yeah.
You know.
And cycling is also, like, it's a, especially to win the tour, it's such a team effort.
Yes.
Really, only like five or six people in the tour have a shot at winning the entire thing.
And the team has to bring those guys to that. Without their team, because, you know, it's all the pacing and everything that goes on.
Yeah, and Lance had great, like, lieutenants, you know. He had great kind of, like, well, they call them domestiques, people that ride for the captain.
And then, yes, but, and lieutenants is a great way to put it, too, in every way.
Yeah.
And they followed his orders, and he was a dominating, domineering personality. You know, he would have run a guy out who wouldn't dope, is my assumption.
I think he did. He pressured most of them to dope. And
right.
It was at a time when, like, it wasn't as widespread, and the technology was there to kind of catch what came before Lance. Like, so you were getting, like, guys were getting banned before that happened. So when Lance stumbled upon, like, his little cocktail that would stay ahead of testing, like, he thought, I can get away with this, but that wasn't the attitude at the time. Forcing people to do it was still kind of...
Oh, yeah.
Not, like, it obviously it was a really shitty, like, manipulative thing to do.
Yes.
And there are a lot of those riders that, you know, he ruined their career, he ruined their integrity.
Completely. Everyone who comes through the story is disgraced.
What bothers me the most about him is that he's like, you know, I'm the greatest. And I'll be like, well, you cheated. He'll be like, I was actually the greatest at cheating, too.
Right.
And you're like,
exactly.
What? No. Well, who cares?
He reminds me of Clemens in a way.
Oh, yeah.
Couple of Texans. Now, with Clemens, the difference is that Lance, right from the get-go, now, in the documentary, they show the year that he gets his ass kicked on the Tour de France, after he's proven himself to be the best, but all these other guys are studying with Ferrari or whatever. Studying, I should say. And all that guy gave him supposedly was EPO or whatever his cocktail was, because he said, you just need the red blood cells, supposedly. And both of those guys, Barry Bonds as well, saw their competition surpassing them due to cheating, and they couldn't deal with that. And so that is what, you know, their competition drove them to that. The difference is, as you say, he pressured other people into doing it. I don't think those guys did.
Right. But it also, like, you know, LeMond saw that. Greg LeMond, who's the only American champion of the Tour de France, who, you know, won it in 86, 89, and 90.
Yes.
All of a sudden in 91, he shows up. He's the best rider in the world.
You know?
And LeMond actually was built, and doctors would say this, LeMond was built like a freak. Like, he was a freak of nature who just happened to have, like, all the ingredients within a normal human body that make you preternaturally, like, amazing at cycling.
Like the secretariat of cycling?
Yes. Like, his oxygen levels were amazing. His leg power was incredible. His endurance was incredible. You know, he could sprint with the best of them. But he was also really adept in the mountains because of where he grew up and where he trained.
Right.
So, and then LeMond wins his third one in 1990, shows up in 1991, and all of a sudden he's like middle of the pack.
Right.
And he's looking around. And he's like, what the hell is going on?
Yep.
Now, the guy that won five in a row after Le Monde was this guy, Miguel Indurain.
Yep. He was Spaniard.
Yeah. And they never caught him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to tell if he's like also preternaturally gifted and he was just younger and stronger than Le Monde,
right,
or if he was like the original bane of cycling, like voided out monster. And that's what changed cycling. Either way, by Le Monde's account and a lot of other people, the beginning of the 90s turns a new leaf, and you can't really tell who's doping and who's not.
Yeah.
And by the time you get to Lance's thing, he's like, if you want to compete, you have to do it this
right,
way.
Right.
But that,
because
that also,
Lance is saying everyone's doping, so are you.
Yeah, exactly. But domestiques weren't necessarily, I don't know,
they didn't have to be doping to do what they did?
Well, they didn't necessarily, because to be honest, a lot of them are grist for the mill.
Right, right. It's just run out there and set the pace and then get exhausted and fall back.
Yeah, exactly. You're not trying to win. You're not trying to place. You're
right.
Not trying to score any points or
right.
any kind of jersey.
Give that guy some cocaine and let him go at the beginning.
Yeah. like in the 50s, you know?
Yes, yes, yes. And probably up through the 80s, I'm sure.
Yeah. But even that, like, you don't come back from that kind of thing. Blood doping was unique in the sense that, like, and this happened in the year after Lance first retires, when Floyd Landis wins in 2006. He has the biggest fall. Like, he's in the yellow jersey. He's in the mountains. And it's probably like two-thirds, three-quarters of the way through the tour. And he collapses.
Yes.
His body can't take it.
Yep.
He loses the yellow jersey. And he loses by one of the biggest margins in the history of the tour. The next day, he comes back. And he makes up more time.
Oh, my God.
In the history of the tour coming from behind. In over 100 years.
Because what, there's did he one get other... like six transfusions?
No, well, here's the other thing. It's like, if everyone's doping at the time, is it still amazing? You
yeah,
know?
Right, right.
Because he had a four-climb day. And Landis also has serious allegations against him for kind of being awful to fellow riders.
Ah.
His story is pretty murky. It's fascinating, but it's pretty murky. Anyway, he attacks on the first climb. So
right.
There are four mountain climbs on that day.
Yep.
And it's ludicrous to attack on the first climb. Maybe you attack on the second to last one. And
sure,
then you
sure.
attack again on the
right,
last
right, to make
one.
Your move near the end, yeah.
But if you're alone, you're always going to get caught after a while because you don't have anyone cutting the wind for you. You can't draft off anyone. It's just pure energy.
Right.
He attacks on the first hill, and then he just keeps going, and he stays alone, and he makes up the most time in like,
oh my 60, God.
Like 70 years or something crazy like that.
Yeah.
And then he ends up winning in a time trial the next day. And that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back for the tour. Cause at that point when he got caught, cause his doping wasn't as sophisticated as Lance's. He didn't have like this like cloak of secrecy. When he gets caught and he gets his title stripped, everyone's like, well, he used to ride for Lance. Then he tried to plead ignorance and
right.
got people to donate money to him. And then when that got found out, when he had to pay everyone back, and the way that Lance gets taken down is he's like, well, shit, I need money.
Yeah.
I just defrauded a bunch of people. Okay, fuck it. I'll flip on Lance.
Yeah. It's crazy. It became like, you know, same thing kind of with baseball is once you get into that, it's funny how the illegal blood doping leads to even more shady stuff. Like in baseball, there's Balco and all these weird fringes of the law people who get involved. And it's kind of like, you know, once you go down that path, it only leads you in one direction. Yeah, it's all murky and bad.
And psychologically, what's weird to me afterwards, I think it's hard to notice this in the moment, and I know this is a loaded word, but like those people feel entitled to cheating because they say, here's a system, I figured out how to beat the system,
yep.
and I should be rewarded for it.
Yes.
And I know entitled is such a loaded word now, but that doesn't mean people stop being entitled.
Oh, God, no.
And that's exactly what it was. Lance is still entitled. He still thinks that he deserves all this positive attention for having, like, mastered this game. And it's like, you brought yourself shame. You brought your country shame. You brought the sport of cycling shame. Like, shut up. Go away.
And he brought, like, the way he did it. Again, I have to, you know, these other guys, they did bad deeds and they justified it with the same level of entitlement and everything. And by the way, entitlement, like, this is the country of entitlement. We're seeing it now. Like, I want to be in a pool. I don't care if I die and other people do. I want to be in a pool. You know, that,
I got to,
like,
get wet.
Yes.
I got to get wet.
Yes. It's like, okay.
Now, let's say you use the right hashtags, and Lance hears this, because I'm sure he's got a bunch of burner accounts.
Sure.
Searches.
Absolutely.
For his era, it was still incredible what he did if he beat a bunch of dopers. But he also may have beaten a bunch of guys who were preternaturally gifted, had trained their entire lives, and didn't dope.
And that's it. The guy who's the head of U.S. Cycling was on the documentary, and he... You know, he says that's what happened to him, you know, that he had that choice to make, and he tried it without, and he faded out. And that's the crime in both of those sports. It's, you know, it's not necessarily Clements and Bonds are going to the Hall of Fame. Actually, they're going to the Hall of Fame more likely if they don't dope. But it's the guys on the fringes who take those jobs. Who's the guy? Melky Cabrera on the Yankees. Made like $80 million or $120 million in his career. And I think he got busted twice for doping. And, okay, that dude's got $80 million. And he probably is, you know, a marginal back and forth minor league fourth, fifth outfielder otherwise.
Yeah.
So the guy who doesn't cheat, who would have been that, is robbed of that.
Well, here's and other people's legacies get downgraded too, because the stats don't get downgraded for inflation.
Right.
Like my favorite baseball player of all time was Mark Grace.
Yeah.
You know, would love to get a beer with him someday and call an Uber. Neither one of us would drive, obviously.
Very way to keep it responsible.
Well, he's got a bunch of DUIs. That was a reference to that.
Oh, that's right. I mean, I want to also say, any baseball player who smokes in the dugout currently has several DUIs.
Yeah. But Grace is the other end of that Melky Cabrera spectrum where, you know, he has the most hits in the 90s.
Yeah.
But right as he's kind of at the end of his prime, and he was a player that, you know, he's a first baseman. Like, you didn't need him to steal bases or anything.
Nope.
He could have gone to the American League and DH'd forever because he was such a good contact hitter. He never struck out. He didn't hit for power. Now, that was okay when you only expected your first baseman to hit 15 homers and drive in 90 runs. But when you expect your first baseman to hit 35 homers and drive in 120 runs, there's a difference. And that robs him of, like...
There's a direct parallel. Rafael Palmeiro, who was coming up the same time with the Cubs, he cheated similar talents. Those guys and Will Clark... We're all in the same realm. Mattingly was a little before, but again, to me, Mattingly for his dominant years was a super duper version of that guy.
I love Mattingly.
But still within the same realm. Not putting up 55 homer years, putting up 38 homer years and hitting 340.
But they can also hit 320 and hit 20 homers for like the rest of their career.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
And it's valuable. And to take it back to cycling, what was so frustrating was that the tour is more, when I was a kid, it was more entertaining when there wasn't that doping because
of course
got the rising and falling of certain, contenders would happen more dramatic. There was more dramatics before all the doping than after.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and tennis might be another, this is a conversation for another day, because as you were talking about that guy and the overtaking and everything, it was reminding me of Nadal coming out and overtaking
Federer.
And I'm not casting any aspersions at any of those guys. You know, history, I think, will sort out what all that is. I do wonder about quarterbacks in the NFL who are so old now going and not breaking down. Although maybe Brady will break down, but we'll see. 41, yeah, you know, that's old.
I mean, I'm not a Patriots fan, but I think Brady is a weird anomaly.
Could be.
And who knows? Maybe who knows how many powers he derives from kissing his son.
And he's also a guy who has a chip on his shoulder. If you, I watched 5 minutes of the golf thing, and I happened to tune in right when Barkley shit talked him, and he hit that, and he hit that shot that went in like a 120-yard shot. So I do think there is a part of Brady that kind of, because of where he was drafted and the doubting, that does drive him.
Yeah, that's. I think he's the right mix of like, you know, crazy good athlete. He comes up at a time when sports science can actually prolong people's careers way more.
And the game is suited to him not getting hit.
And the system too.
Yes,
and they protected him.
Oh God, we could talk about the Bucks too next season. Well, this has gone more than enough.
Yeah, and I didn't even. Well, if anyone wants.
Yeah, go on.
Wants
go
recommendations
on.
For the tour. If you're like, you know what, I've always liked the tour. I don't know much about it. There are a couple great documentaries that you can find out there. But if you just want to focus in on like what the story is of one, like you find there's some great documentaries that just basically show you the highlights and the big storylines of tours. They're like an hour long.
Sure.
Go with the 1986 tour. That's the first one that Greg LeMond wins.
First American ever to win. Probably a South American's won it, I would guess. But maybe, certainly first American, yeah.
Actually, I think the first...
Non-European?
Last year was the first South American to win, I think.
Oh, wow. So maybe he's the first non-European to win.
LeMond was the first American. LeMond was the first American to win a stage in the mountains. Like my grandpa was like, they're not mentally fit for the tour. They can't do it.
It's interesting where those prejudices, you know, until it gets broken.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I'd say that the 86 tour is incredible. Then LeMond gets, LeMond actually gets shot accidentally in a hunting accident.
Oh shit.
With his brother-in-law or uncle or something like that.
Accidentally.
Misses the next 2 years, comes back in 1989.
Holy crap.
With like 30 pellets still in his body, almost died, and wins the 89 tour in the most amazing. It's the closest tour in the history of the Tour de France. So that's 89. So I'd recommend those two.
Got
it. If you're an American and you want a good introduction to the tour.
Oh, my God. Is that where the word Peloton comes from?
No. No.
Brian Gallivan would be happy with that joke.
Yeah.
Give me any more recommendations quickly before, of course, Breaking Away, if you want to get real deep into it.
Yeah, Breaking Away is great. There's what's the Lance Armstrong movie that Ben Foster plays the lead in? If you want a good representation without having to actually look at look at Lance's face or
because it's I'm sure it's an unauthorized movie based on him.
Yeah, but it's fantastic and it covers.
Do you know what it's called?
It's called The Program. Yeah, The Program.
The Program. All right. You sure that's not the Shaq movie?
No, that's Blue Chips. Although there was a football movie with James Caan.
Right. That's
Program,
it. That's it. James Caan. Nice.
But no, this one was 2015. Ben Foster crushes it.
All right.
Jesse Plemons plays Floyd Landis.
Ooh, I'm going to check this out today if I can.
Yeah, it's worth a watch. So start there.
I will. All right. Well, Tim, do you have anything that you want to plug right now? Anything that's going on in your quarantine? You doing any kind of quarantine journaling?
I'll plug masks for people who don't want to kill their families or the families of people in their communities.
I think that's a good plug. And you know what? And we'll finish because life is a herald, Tim. And so is this episode. When you mentioned masks, describing that glasses bit you did, one of the best shows, the only show I think I saw that Sharna directed was a mask show where like guys like Stephanie Weir and Rich Tallarico and Craig Kakowski had these masks that they would put on, look in the mirror, and get their character down, and then they would come out and improvise scenes in these characters with these weird masks on. And so that was what that piece you did, the positive guy?
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Reminded me of. Wow. Yeah. Well, so you reminded me of something Sharna directed.
Well, our Sharna episode is going to...
Oh. We got to have her on for it.
Hi, baby. Okay, baby.
All right. Thank you, Tim, and good luck to you. And yes, wear a mask, everybody. Have a good one,
thanks,
man.
Thanks, Joe.
All right,
you
later.
Too, man.
Bye.
Bye.
And that was Tim Baltz. Thank you very much, Tim, for a very interesting conversation. Folks, I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you tomorrow for your daily sports dump. Later. Oh, tomorrow we'll have Dan back at all. Also stage of Star and Screen. He'll be yelling about something. All right, bye.